Tēnā koutou katoa, nā mai, haere mai. Welcome to DWC's Forever a Coaster series. Today I'm talking to the Director General of the Department of Conservation, Lou Sanson. Lou is also the former head of Antarctica New Zealand and Forever a Coaster, who grew up in Hokitika. Welcome, Lou.
Kia ora, Julie. Great to be here.
So as boss of DOC, it's clear you have a professional connection with the coast, but what about personally?
Oh, look. I grew up there, my mum's still there. I just love, you know, I get, every time I go over Arthur's Pass or fly in, it just feels like coming home, and it's just this really, really special place. And in lockdown, you know, one of the most wonderful places in the world, and we just feel very privileged that although we can't go outside this country, we can still go to the coast and just get our batteries recharged by those incredible landscapes and incredible people.
I've heard it said that you have actually walked every possible track on the coast. Is this true?
Yeah, well, I used to play rugby, but in the end, the coach said, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to play rugby or are you going to go hunting and tramping? And because I used to play rugby and then I'd go tramping when the weather was fine and I'd only play rugby when it was wet. So I sort of made the choice to... And I had this ambition as, you know, my mother dragged me through the mountains. You know, my parent, she grew up at Inchbonnie and she's an artist and she was constantly on the tops, roaring up stags and peeling off fuchsia bark and doing these beautiful paintings. And she's still doing paintings and art exhibitions in Hokitika. And there was this deep love of nature that she gave me through sort of the Dillons up, the, living with the Dillons up the Taupo Valley and dragging me up to over the three pass trip. And then I just said, right, I'm going to try and walk every valley between Reefton and Haast by the time I'm 17 when I go to university. And I pretty much nailed it, apart from a couple of deep, only dark valleys in southwestern, like the Makawhio.
So do you still, obviously there's even more tracks now, do you still get out in your spare time and get...
Yeah, look, just before Christmas, I took the chief executive of Genesis Energy, Mark England, into... at the Copeland, and that's where I did my first job working for Jeff Renison. I was track cutting up there at the age of 15, and it was just such a thrill to go back in there and sit in the hot pools, and you know, because they've given us over $10 million towards FIO and see some FIO in the river there. Yeah, no, I still get out there while I can, and ski touring every year. I'm back up in the Fox or the Franz neves and watching those sunsets at Pioneer Hut.
It's not too bad a life down there, is it?
Oh, look, I spent Queen's Birthday. You know, as soon as lockdown finished, I wanted to go down and see my mum. And then I went to Okarito to Andy Apps, who's a great mate of mine. And, you know, New Zealand's probably best landscape photographer. And boy, the winter on the West Coast is just incredible. You know, and I just thought we go all around the world to get these incredible experiences. And Okarito in midwinter is better than anywhere else I've seen in the world.
It's amazing. What are your best memories of growing up around Hokitika?
Oh, look, probably, you know, damming dams. We had a gold mine up the spur, and mum used to, you know, as soon as it was raining, we'd go and build the dams and get the riffle box out and get enough gold for our wives' wedding rings and getting crawlies out of the river, white baiting, going up Canary Road, selling rabbits that I'd got on the island when I built a canoe and possuming and shooting a deer, you know, and sort of all my first money came from whitebait, deer, possums and rabbits, really.
I heard a story about your dad went off to Antarctica for a lengthy period. Is that correct?
Yeah, Dad had this great love affair with Antarctica. He was an electrical engineer. He was working on the Waikato dams, and Mum just had this huge passion. She didn't like the Waikato. She wanted to get back to Inchbonnie and Lake Brunner and Hokitika. And of course, Dad couldn't get a job as an engineer. So he ended up teaching the rest of his life, but he did get selected to do a study on the upper ionosphere on auroras in Antarctica. And at that time, it was only 4 years after Hillary had opened Scott Base. And the only way we could talk to him was to go up to 4ZA, I think it was, or the radio station, where we got the long-wave radio. And of course, being in Hokitika, we didn't have Woolworths or... and of course, we were more interested in going to Woolworths and getting the pick and mix than we were talking to Dad. And we'd sit there, Mum's trying to talk to Dad, and we'd be fighting over some pick and mix. And So it was more about getting the trip to Woolworths.
Kenzie were next door to each other.
Yeah, yeah. And we sort of went to between the two to work out which had the best pick and mix.
The main street of Greymouth. Those were the days.
Yeah. It was so cool. It's like going to the big smoke, going from Hoagie to Greymouth.
Was it, do you think it was your parents who influenced you to want to grow up and be a park ranger, which I believe was your original hope that you could become a park ranger?
Yeah, well, I was doing the three pass with, there was two people that were really influential. Jeff Renison, he was the chief ranger at Fox Glass, and he came to Hokitika High School and he stood up on stage and he just talked about working in national parks, and he gave me my first job track cutting. And the other one was my mother and I were doing the three pass trip, and we got into grassy flats and I met a couple of foresters, and they had the key to the forestry cupboard. And at the time, you know, I was lugging around all this food and I thought, wow, there's the ideal job. They got a key to the forestry cupboard. It's full of flour and tang and baked beans. And I thought, that's the job I want. And from that moment on, I said, I applied for National Park and I'm applying for that forestry job. And didn't get accepted to National Park, didn't get accepted to Wildlife Service, but got accepted as a forester trainee. And I made a point of just spending so much time at Forest Service in Hokitika and getting to know Tony Newton and Ray Forsyth and all these people that built all the huts, you know. And as fast as they were building huts, he was a young Lou sort of wandering into the water art of these brand new huts. And it was just heaven.
So these huts, I presume, had a cupboard in which the ranger's store was kept. Locked.
Yeah. The Forest Service had a store, and you know, I was just a tramper or a hunter, and shot my first deer.
You don't carry it around. You don't
take a gorge, and yeah, I know. And I thought, no, that's the job. I need to somehow get into those cupboards.
You know, I think we all share that great childhood memories of growing up on the West Coast. Do you look at yourself and Aaron, see any personal attributes, and go, or hear yourself say something, and go, that's so West Coast?
Yeah, no, I've got, you know, I use a word called huru, you know, which is sort of goodbye, and, you know, things like we and pungas, and, you know, there is batch, and, you know, I went to South London and there they were cribs, and, you know, I did 22 years, and I went in Invercargill, and of course Bill English told me a Southlander is naturally a West Coaster that's been to finishing school, so... And that's pretty much how it felt. I just felt the people in Southland were every bit as good as the people in the West Coast. And, I just found a natural affinity to Southland, and mainly because I'd been reading all these books of moose that were released at the Hokie Gorge, and Percy Lies from Hokitika had shot the last moose, and Wet Jacket Arm, and I had this fascination about Fiordland.
So you went from Hokitika to Southland, then to Antarctica, and then to Wellington, to, you know, heading a major government department. Tell us a little bit about that journey. Why did you originally have to leave Hokitika to go to Southland?
Well, I did a forestry degree. I couldn't become a park ranger. I couldn't become a wildlife service officer. So I thought, and I got to know these, you know, I headed over Arthur's Pass. I think I had a Honda 100 bike and I drove off and it blew up at Kawaka, and but I really got to enjoy the forestry degree people, and then I did 2 years at Forest Research Institute and Mountain Lion Management, and ended up helping Sid James with, you know, some of his logging trials at Okarito, and I was working up at Reefton on the geohydrology studies, and then I was up in the Alps doing the grassland surveys and plots all the way up the Copeland, and yeah, it just seemed, wow, this is an incredible career, and this is my love affair with the Southern Alps, and it was just a natural progression to the Southland, and setting up Stewart Island National Park, the World Heritage Area for the Sub-Antarctics, but it was the skills I'd learnt on the coast. It was the ability to see these places as belonging to the people of New Zealand, not to the government, if you like, and It's the people at Tua Tapri and the people at Haast, that is their place. Yeah. And it's just you've got to actually work through what it means to shoot a deer, drive a jet boat, take a four-wheel drive, you know, conserve, do pest eradication, and each community is different. And I don't think you should do these jobs unless you've done the hard yards out there, unless you've sat at those public meetings and Tua Tapri or Harry till sort of 9 o'clock at night, or, you know, I don't think you should be in Wellington unless you actually understand how regional New Zealand works. And that's the skill I've got out of the coast, is the ability to work out public policy and go with, find the compromise that's the win-win. And, you know, we've clearly got some issues with TAR at the moment, but I'm sure in there somewhere is a compromise, and we've got to find it, and we'll do it.
So what, how did the progression to being head of Antarctica New Zealand come about?
Well, I was a field assistant. I'd sort of, since Dad had been in Antarctica, I read lots and about Antarctica, and I applied to be a field assistant. I spent 5 months down there. And when I came back, I was made redundant. I was laid off from the Forest Service, and well, they'd shifted me to Tapa Nui, and I thought, I don't want to go to Tapa Nui. So I went overseas for a year and a half and came back and ended up with the environmental forestry job in Invercargill. And then the CEO job came up, and it was just a natural progression from running the sub-Antarctic islands. I've been doing a bit of work in my holidays on cruise ships, Zodiac driving in Antarctica. So, yeah, no, it was just a match made in heaven. And to have 11 years running the Antarctic program, which was very similar to DOC. You know, we had to get, you know, relationships with China, Russia, Spain. You know, if you take that away, and they all have different attributes, it's no different to being on the coast, where there's a different view between forest and bird and fishers and hunters. And you had to find the sweet spot to create the world's largest protected area, to create the Dry Valleys managed area. And I guess that ability to sit and listen to people, regardless of the perspective, regardless of their Korean, Russia or Japan, around the table, actually was a skill that, because Antarctica is the biggest consensus in the world. It's the whole system. We argue it's more successful than the United Nations, and it's all about finding that sweet spot. And when New Zealand's, you know, pretty snotty with Japan over whaling, you sit around that treaty table and Japan's not very pleasant to New Zealand. So the same behaviours play out, and you've just got to learn how to work with people and take people with you, which is the skill that coasters have in droves.
That is a great skill, that ability to compromise, especially given the sometimes controversial nature of your job. Is it fair to say that coasters have a love-hate relationship with DOC?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I the first meeting I did with COVID, I went with all the West Coast local government chairs and CEs and the regional council and the iwi leaders. And I just think they were really appreciative of sitting around the table discussing some of the issues, like mining and, you know, the significant natural areas. But they all told me, Lou, you have to go and help at France and Fox, which is bleeding tourism, and that's your highest priority. And that's exactly what we did on their advice. And I just think and that's what I appreciate Minister Sage. When the tough gets going, you know, she does go, and she does go and meet with, you know, the chair of the regional council, Alan Birchfield, and the mayors. And, you know, that's a great skill of a politician, that when it's not very pleasant to go in there. And I think that's what we have to do. And that's what we're paid to do.
Do you think Wellington, therefore, has an impression of coasters being, you know, mining crazy, and, you know, like they don't really understand the West Coast way? Is there a lack of understanding in Wellington?
I don't know if there is. You know, I work with the tourism side a lot, and, you know, all the discussion I hear is how do we look after the West Coast? I just think, you know, these issues are polarised. There will be debates about mining or protection or tourism or fishing or hunting. And that's what we're paid to do, the jobs we're doing, you know, absolutely, to listen to people and find the way forward when it looks impossible.
Is that the way you're feeling about TAR? Is this your latest?
Yeah, she's a tough one. You know, there's a few threats out there, and, you know, it's not very pleasant on social media. If you if if you want to sort of think, oh, this doesn't look very pleasant, go to social media. And
social media is not very pleasant.
no. And you just, but look, I I'm a tar hunter myself. I've been up in the Horace Walker and up in the head of the Copeland and places like that. I think we probably dropped the ball for a long time. We didn't do much. I think West Coast did more than Canterbury. So I don't think the issue is big on the West Coast as it is in Canterbury. I know Mike Slater kept up the TAR program. He's got some superb people there with, who were doing some of the hunting in South Westland. There is an interest group there who regard, you see those images of a bull tar on a mountain ridge and they're amazing. But then you see the photos of the ranunculus and they think, yeah, well, we've got to work out that they're both special for certain people. And again, we've got to find a way through it.
West Coasters can often feel like that from the outside, people don't understand the damage, for example, the tar do. People just see a beautiful animal, they don't understand, and therefore they judge the West Coast.
Yeah, so I went hunting with a friend recently and, we hired a helicopter out of Fox and went up into the Karangarua and I just, we got no tar, we spent 4 days hunting but on the way out, we just saw in these inaccessible places just hundreds and hundreds of tar and there's no way I, as a tar hunter, could actually even get to that place. Mm-hmm. And I think if we clean those areas up and because the areas were completely out and we've enabled tar hunters, we've created blocks, we allow them to fly into wilderness areas, we are doing all we possibly can to look after them. But we do have to look after our vegetation and our national parks too.
Changing the subject slightly, is business and doc working together your biggest challenge, to have business and doc?
I think it's our biggest opportunity. And what was amazing during lockdown was, we have about 50 million in commercial partnerships with Air New Zealand, Fulton Hogan, Mitre 10, Genesis Meridian. They all stood up. Toyota, Alistair Davis, the CEO of Toyota, said, Lou, we are really bleeding. We were a third of our business was tourism. It's 45 rental car companies in Christchurch and Queenstown, and that business has disappeared. And he said to me, we're going through hard times, but Toyota's going to stick by Doc because what you do is have so many young New Zealanders fall in love with nature, and that's what Toyota wants. And although we can probably hardly afford it at the moment, we're going to come through this. I just think it's one of our biggest opportunities. I think that's what's unique about Doc. Is during COVID, we had more people coming to form relationships with the department because business recognises that nature sits at the heart of our economy, whether we're marketing milk, whether wine, it's that brand. And we know when tourism comes back, they're coming back for these incredible places like the West Coast.
You said when you started at Doc that one of your priorities was to have Doc seen as vital to the tourism industry. Has that happened?
Yeah, I think so. And probably, we had 64% growth. When I started, we had virtually no relationship with Tourism New Zealand. And now we're just linked at the hip with Tourism New Zealand. So we are at the heart of these economies and just ensuring that, helicopters can access, people like Jerry McSweeney can operate their lodges, the various rafting and operations can operate without creating, and this is the tension you get because the Federated Mountain Clubs like the peace acquired of those upper neves or valleys and hunters like their bit and you've got to find that sweet spot between what is good use of public land for all New Zealanders and really that's our job.
The compromise, the great compromise.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You're right that Doc's profile got even higher during COVID. Can you round up for us what opportunities have come particularly out of glacier country within Doc? Post-COVID?
Post-COVID, look, what I saw with Wayne Costello, who's our manager there, is he really became at the heart of, can these businesses survive? All the migrant workers, what's happening with their immigration issues? How do we run civil defence? Basically, our systems are at the heart of those two communities, and with the loss of the Fox Road, what other opportunities do we put around Fox that keeps people staying there? So, you know, this is DOC not being DOC, but thinking about those communities. And we're in discussions now about the fantastic work being done at Whatarau with Pred to Free. Can we move that out into all those forests around Harihari and Whatarau and actually deal with TB at the same time? So we get Kiwi, TB free, plus the biggest predator free area in New Zealand. And we're so proud of what we've done in the Perth and the Whatarau with our hunters. We've got 12,000 hectares completely free of rats, stoats and possums. That's just one of the most stunning achievements we've ever done towards predator free, and the ability to now push that out.
If people want to work with DOC and these things, do they need to get out their wet weather gear and their shovel, or what sort of opportunities are there within DOC?
Well, I was at Ocarina, and the skydive operation from Franz was the skydivers were all doing the track up to Ocarina's trig. And I think the Samoan chef from the cafe at Fox Glacier Guides was doing Gavian baskets up the Copeland. And he seemed to be happier doing that than he was being the chef. So, look, yeah. You look at any of those people working in the tourism industry, they could equally be DOC. They have a love of nature, a love of people. You put them in DOC uniform, they don't look any different to us. And that's what we're trying to do down there. I think this week we've amped it up to 50 of those people working for the department, knowing that we're hoping. I think the problem we're seeing is we're seeing a real expansion of New Zealanders within 3 hours of cities, but Fox and Franz is 5 hours, and we're just hoping that summer period will stand those businesses up again with New Zealanders. And if we can actually keep those people in those communities employed by us, so that in come October, November, they can go back skydiving and glacier guiding and rafting, whatever.
Are these common issues around New Zealand, or do you think glacier country is special when it comes to this?
We think the two areas most hit in this crisis are Te Anau and Fox and Franz and perhaps Haast. Makarora seems to have come through. I was talking to the owner of all the accommodation there, and he says, well, we're going pretty good. But our biggest worry would be Te Anau. And that's another destination that's more than 3 hours from a major city. But Stewart Island's going... I was on Stewart Island recently, and they're having the busiest winter they've ever had. So it's pretty weird, and we can't even predict 3 months, let alone next year. And Kiwis are fickle beasts. They, you know, they're pouring into Stewart Island, but they're not going near Milford. So what is that about?
Do you have a vision for tourism post-COVID? You know, when the international tourists do come back, would you like to see a different tourist?
Well, basically what we've done, and I guess the idea came out of working with Ngāi Tahu and iwi leaders and various mayors, including some of your mayors, is actually, can we use this unique period in New Zealand's history to really focus on our environment and go charge up predator-free, wilding pines, wallabies, freshwater, and when the tourist comes back, we really are 100% pure. So that's our vision, really, is to employ 13,000 people on that vision and move New Zealand up the value chain. I'm not sure if everybody wants this huge number of people living in vans back, but I'm sure that people want people paying $100 or $150 a night in a motel or paying for a campground. And I think that was the part of the problem we had, is as fast as tourism was going, we were developing all these lay-bys and they were becoming new campgrounds. So I think we want value over volume, and with the international visitor levy, I think we'll be one of the most desired places in the world, up with Iceland, maybe Costa Rica, Norway, in terms of these landscapes. But when tourism comes back, we might be charging $100 at the border because of the experience you're going to have in New Zealand, as opposed to mass tourism places like Japan and Europe.
In hindsight, did we do too much for the Freedom Camper or the van or car camper rather than the self-contained vehicles?
I think it got a bit out of hand, and I think we started to lose social licence. And you know, I heard the West Coast campground owners, you know, as we developed these solutions, we were taking work away from them. You know, we built that big new campsite at Mount Roy at Wanaka. We should have never done it. I think we paid $500,000 to develop it and was full the first day. We should have talked to the locals and said, we'll get a park and ride running out of Wanaka. And then Blue Pools, that was another one that just exploded. And so now we've made it a half-hour walk. And Hokitika Gorge, we're just so thrilled to be opening that. And because we've turned it from a 10-minute walk into a decent 45-minute walk. And every tourist that we get slow down a bit and see a bit more of the coast, we get another dollar out of them. And really that's our whole strategy is to stop them driving through the West Coast in a day. That's why we're doing up Operara. That's why we're investing large money at Punakaiki. And we are just thrilled to bits about what we've done with Hoki Gorge. And I can still remember in 1972, leading the Hoki High School Ecological Society to save the logging of the Hoki Gorge and stop Forest Service bridging it.
Do you think, have you been surprised by the domestic tourists, the way they've kind of come to the party? I mean, I went to Queenstown on the weekend and it was chock full of New Zealanders, you know. It was unusual. Not so many in the souvenir shops, but a lot in the bars.
We are stunned, we're wrapped. Our Great Walks are 50% ahead of last year. Everything we're putting out there is getting booked or used. There's been an explosion in people mountain biking. West Coast is probably one of the best mountain biking places in the world. When you look at the old Ghost Road and the West Coast Wilderness Trail, the Heafy. We're wrapped. The Kiwis are falling in love with nature and you know, we just need to get them into Southwest and that's where we want them to go. And Karamea.
You've got your fingers in all sorts of pies, looking after everybody. Do you think that people understand how you make decisions? You know, is it legislation or the direction of your minister, or are you making the decisions yourself, you know, because you do come under quite a bit of criticism, whatever decision you make? Do people understand the process?
Yeah, so the Westminster tradition is I represent the natural environment of New Zealand. So I am giving advice to my minister about what is within our legislation that we can do, and the Minister of Primary Industries is bringing advice from his officials about the Prime Ministry, and the Minister of Tourism is bringing that, and as long as officials know that is their role, and then the political arm is actually to make those decisions on behalf of New Zealanders, that's the only way Western democracy can represent. And you know, we do try to work very closely with MPI and tourism to sort issues out, but there'll be fundamental issues like Waitaha Hydro that for obvious reasons have to be a ministerial decision. And so provided I am representing the issues relating to that and MBs relating to the energy issues, you know, mining's no different. And that's the fundamental makeup of our government is we bring these issues to the government of the day to make decisions on behalf of the people of New Zealand.
So it's not your decision?
Well, lots of decisions are mine, but you know, and we operate. I think what's wonderful about DOC is the role of the conservation boards, and this was put in place in 1987 to actually take away those decisions about where helicopters will land or where we're going to have gondolas or things like that, to actually empower the communities of the West Coast and Southland to actually have a management plan, which I'm obligated to deliver because it's signed off by the Conservation Authority. So the board and the Conservation Authority work for the minister, not for me. And my power comes in implementing those plans. So each plan is negotiated at place. So that's why the appointments to the conservation boards and the Conservation Authority are so important, because they should be represented of the community and with our treaty partner relationship at the real heart.
One thing that is very healthy on the West Coast is startups. There are, you know, we're never short of startup businesses. Are there opportunities for startups to work with DOC? You know, it's DOC now saying, you know, we're looking for small tourism businesses to start, you know, like to use our land or our facilities.
Yeah. So, what's a recent one? I guess we're seeing all the industry, the tourism coming out of Hokitika Gorge. You know, some of those new initiatives, but even skydiving at Fringe, you know, that comes with some conflict over locals with Okarita, and you've got to work through that one. And you know, in every startup, there'll be another group that says, you know, well, we have some issues with that. So. Look, there's always opportunities, but some of the more interesting ones are Naitahu, with sort of trying to look at some of the perfume that could be taken from Dacrydium biform, the pink pine. Wow. And some of the Selmizia plants. And remember, they have ownership of those species in terms of the Y262 claim. And Naitahu is increasingly moving into that really innovative space that thinks, you know, these cultural materials have value beyond our culture, that we should be actually thinking how we use in creating a perfume industry or the DNA from these plants that we can use for medicines and things like that.
So according to DWC's business survey, 70% of the people have viewed the overall quality of life as an advantage of doing business on the West Coast. But you know, having 84% of the region's conservation land does present its challenges. Is it possible for the extractive industries to grow on the West Coast?
Well, we're having discussions, and the minister's opened these discussions with the chair of the regional council, Alan Birchfield. Are there some places where there are no conservation values, where we can, and you know, the gold belt sort of runs between Greymouth and Ross, and are there some places there that we can look at? And so she's been very open in talking to Alan and saying, look, let's sit down and talk about these. So, you know, it's not no over everything. It's let's try and balance the values of what we're trying to do and see how we can help. You know, most of our mines are on the West Coast, and they've been operating for years, and our whole mining unit is run by Judy Brennan at Hokitika, and she does a phenomenal job over the whole country, licensing mining from everywhere, from the Coromandel to Southland.
What do you think the West Coast can be famous for?
I think it's famous for one of the greatest drives in the world, and that drive, if you drive from Makarora to Karamea, I think, and you get the weather conditions right. You know, I love winter and the snow-capped mountains. I just don't think there's a drive in the world that comes close to the beauty of that place, and just stopping at those places along the way and watching those waves and seeing those Rimu forests in South Westland, and just meeting the people. I that's what it's famous for. I just think it's that strip of that long, long strip of one of the most fantastic drives in the world that really is at the heart of why so many people were coming to New Zealand to experience it.
So do you both personally and as Director General of DOC have a dream for the West Coast? Something that you hope to achieve?
The dream is we're linked at the hip with coasters. We're getting on really well with local government, and we actually can see the win-win, you know, that we can see both as a place. DOC and local government can work linked at the hip. We're working out how to save Franz Josef, be it the river, being at the stock bank. We're dealing with the issue of dumps. We're resolving this mining debate that we're constantly having. We've got through the tar debate. We agree on the 1080 debate. That's the dream, but is it reality? I don't know. You'd like to think you can do it, but you probably spend a lifetime on it.
You probably have for you your ideal job. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're living your dream. You're working your dream.
Yeah, absolutely. The Antarctic job was pretty cool, but sort of a lot of New Zealanders aren't interested in Antarctica. And this job everybody's interested. And you know, I'm looking after 30% of New Zealand on behalf of the minister and the government. And there's not a boring day ever.
When will we next see you down on the coast then?
Well, I've made my promise to the Cave Creek families that I'll be there at Labor weekend. And I'm planning on coming to that opening of Hoki Gorge at Conservation Week, because Hoki Gorge is so special, because I do feel I helped save it and create this opportunity, which our doc staff have now taken ahead. But to me, Cave Creek goes to the heart of who we are and why safety is so important. And you know, this is the 30-year anniversary, and it's so important that I'm there for those families, and I've got to know them, because we will never replace what we took from them. But just my huge respect for those families and what happened at Cave Creek all those years ago. It's really important I'm there.
It is. It's forever a coaster. Thank you, Lou Sanson.